In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with writer Edwige Dandicat. She has been called both the most important Haitian-American writer today and also has been listed among some of America's most talented young writers. She was born in Haiti. She came to the United States when she was 12 and did a lot of her growing up in New York. She's the author of several books, including Breath, Eyes, Memory, and Crick Crack, which was a National Book Award finalist. Also, The Farming of Bones, which was an American Book Award winner. She has a new novel out, which is titled The Dewbreaker. It is out in the bookstores now. It's published by Knopf. If you're interested in looking at it, you can head out to the bookstores. She's now spending some time traveling around the country talking about the book, and in fact today is in Chicago. There will be an appearance at the Borders in Beverly. She'll be doing a reading followed by taking questions from people there and doing a book signing. That's at 7:30 tonight. So if you might happen to be listening in the Chicago area, you can go down there and see her. And of course, here on the program, questions are welcome as we talk. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL here in Champaign-Urbana, which may not be an easier way to remember it, 333-9455, and also toll-free 800-222-9455. Ms. Dandica, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure. I've been looking over your tour schedule. It looks absolutely exhausting. I'm not exactly sure how it is that authors manage to do this.
Well, I guess, you know, I tell myself that it's sort of an intense period of time, and then you quietly go back home to work. So it's it gets us out of the house for a little bit.
Well, I'm glad that you can talk with us about your new book. The book begins where you introduce us to a man and his daughter, and the man is the person referred to in the title. And what happens in the course of that chapter is that she, the daughter, comes to realize that her father is not the man that she thought, or at least as she thought about his past. He is completely different, and that in this sense that she thought that back in Haiti when he was living there, that he was likely a victim of political torture, and she finds out that in fact no, he wasn't the victim; he was the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is something that he's been keeping secret from her for pretty much her whole life, and so the book starts out with that that revelation, if you will, and he, it is prompted by a sort of honor that she bestows upon him. She's a sculptor, and decides that she will honor him with one of her by portraying him in her work, and so this prompts him to feel very sort of undeserving, and that's why he makes this confession.
And it's. And I wonder, I guess it's an interesting choice, the way the book is structured, because it is a series of what could be independent stories that stand on their own that are linked by the fact that the people in them are linked. And it isn't till so you begin with this revelation where the daughter finds out that her father was a torturer for the Duvalier regime in the 60s. And then it's not until the end that you actually get the story, that the reader gets the story of what happened. So there's this one big basic piece of information, but not much else right at the start. And then you take us all through the lives of a number of other people before you get back to the Dewbreaker. And I wonder how it is that you thought about approaching telling the story and why it is that you did it like that.
Well, the story itself, in some ways, lent me the structure. The first story that I wrote is the one that we've been talking about, The Book of the Dead, in which this young artist and her father go on this trip, and this revelation is made. And once I was done writing that story, I was extremely curious about the father. And then so I wrote this piece, the last piece, which is the longest piece. And then in that piece, sort of it is revealed that he has a wife and so forth. And so then I wrote another piece called The Book of Miracles, in which we meet the wife. So it's sort of unspooled in that fashion. And they were meant to be, each of those stories, it's sort of like a puzzle, as some readers have said, in that they're meant to be pieces that you can kind of get a glimpse of something alone in them. But if you read them together, you sort of get some insight into each of the other stories and then into the entire picture. So I think, but also the subject of the book, I think, lends itself to the structure in that when we're putting together fragments of a past, like this past that the characters, and on some level, I myself am looking at of this 29-year dictatorship. So you need many different voices to put together this kind of story, and that one person can tell the story. So that the perpetrator needs the others, you know, the people who he has touched to tell his story, and they need him to tell their story on some level.
Mm. Do you think of this as a novel?
I think of it as stories myself, and sort of we had a kind of middle compromise with the publisher, because I had written them as individual stories, but realized that when they did come together, they came together as something other. So it is something between a novel and a collection of short stories, but I would say it's closer to a collection of stories.
Mm. In that first story, I wanted to try and talk about it without giving so much away that people will feel that they don't need to go out and read it. As you've sketched it out, the father and the daughter are together, and it revolves around this sculpture that the daughter has done of the father. And they're going to, someone has agreed to buy it, and they're going to take it there. And the father disappears with the sculpture. Mm-hmm. And eventually what happens is that she finds her father and gets the story of the fact that he was a torturer when he was back in Haiti. And in the course of all of this, she calls her mother. Mm-hmm. And at one point she calls her mother and tells her, that is, the daughter tells the mother what her father has told her. And there's this conversation that goes on between the mother and the daughter, and essentially, and because the mother knows also and has known all this time. And the mother, the daughter asks mother, how could you love this man, knowing what it was that he did and who he is? And she says something like, well, she thinks that her presence in his life and the daughter's presence has changed him, or at least offered him the opportunity to be a different person. And so she says that the way she feels, that it's as if they have rescued him.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems that's a really important question that the daughter asks the mother when she asks how can you love him?
Well, and I think that this presents to the daughter, and it presents on some level to all people who are faced with this kind of situation, and not to use an easy paradigm, you know, of forgiveness. But this harder kind of love, you know, that this love that on some level demands forgiveness every day, which is the kind of love this mother's struggling with, and that on some level the daughter, unless she eventually cuts them out of her life forever, will have to face. It's sort of, you know, the story and on some level raises those questions, like how do we love these kinds of people that perhaps the world considers unlovable. And I think on many levels it's a very difficult kind of love, and it requires renewal every single day, and maybe that's, you know, that's what the mother is unable to verse to her daughter, but that's the way she lives this love, you know. Mm-hmm. And she uses many different kinds of justifications for herself, that maybe in the beginning it was a kind of this feeling that she was rescuing someone. But it's a love that is tested every day, that is tried every day, that's renewed every day. So I think that's really the first question of the very first story, and I think that's and it's a question that I imagine all the other characters who who were touched by this man would be asking this woman, how do you love him? Because they would never see the opportunity or they would never have the ability perhaps to even like him, much less love him.
Hmm. Well, that seems, obviously, that's the overall question of the book, that two big things, one being that, one big themes, one being that nobody escapes their past.
Mm-hmm.
It never goes away. But then the other question is it possible to, I'm not sure what the right word to use would be, to transcend, to rise above, to start again, to be redeemed, all of those things, then that it asks the question, even having had that kind of a past, is it, you'd say, okay, it's never forgotten, but do you somehow move forward from that, do something different, do something else?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've always, for me, on some level, those questions, like raising the question is a lot more interesting than trying to find an answer to them. And that even the daughter asking that question, you know, she knows, you know, how do you love him? She knows that there's no answer to that question, but it's an important question to be raised. So what I hope is, as you know, as people go through the book and encounter these characters, that these are questions that will be raised for each individual, so that they'll ask themselves, you know, they'll be able to put themselves in that position in some level to do what fiction forces us to do, you know, is to imagine ourselves making certain choices and knowing that, asking ourselves what kind of choices we would make, knowing on some level, in some way, that there is no right choice, and that for each person it's an individual choice.
Well, as before we could do that as readers, you have to do that as the writer.
Mm-hmm.
What was that experience like for you, or did you try to put yourself in the frame of mind of the daughter, of the mother, and thinking to yourself, well, what if this was me? What if this was my father? Or what if this was my husband?
Well, I think, you know, someone has said that sometimes writing can be a lot like acting, method acting specifically, and that you have to be able to put yourself in everybody's shoes, and that you have to be the father, you have to be the daughter, and that you have to imagine from really the deepest place in you what your core reaction would be, and maybe and try to place that on somebody else and try to imagine it for them. So it was somewhat difficult, especially with the father, imagining a torturer, imagining myself in the daughter's position or in the wife's position. But we have to do that from many different perspectives if you want to write truthfully about somebody like that. And that people like that or any other kind of people are rarely very simple or one-sided. So I had to really make myself explore all the sides to this man, all the sides to this situation, in order to be able to write it convincingly. And this is maybe one of the ways that the structure of the book, you know, this all these interconnected testimonials almost and stories contribute to the book, in that I could imagine him from all these different people's eyes, from all their different perspectives, and then at the end assemble enough of the sort of the outer glance on him to be able to construct a fuller picture of him from within himself. And I think even people in that situation must have some moments of regret. So I had to imagine myself in that. And there's a level, too, where people like that are created by their environment, and that's not an excuse. But a good place to start to imagine them fully is to examine the environment that creates them.
Hmm. Our guests in this hour of Focus 580, Edwige Dandika, has a new novel out. It's titled The Dewbreaker. It's published by Knopf and is out in bookstores now. She is traveling around the country talking about it. She's in Chicago. Questions here are welcome to 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number. It's 800-222-9455. The man that we're talking about here and his family, they're now living in is in the book, in the present of the book. They're living in New York, mm-hmm. And live very quietly and purposefully live quietly. They don't have a lot of friends. They keep an intentionally low profile, apparently because they're afraid that someone from the past, someone in the Haitian community there, will recognize him.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the, you know, the daughter, she starts reflecting on the fact that they did live that way, and that they didn't seem to have a lot of friends, and nobody ever came over to the house. And after she gets this understanding of her father and who he is, then that becomes a little bit more clear to her why it is that they've lived that way. Is it actually possible to see him as also a prisoner who is in some way suffering as a consequence of the act of his actions? Again, it's not to excuse or not to somehow equate that level of suffering with that he would have visited on other people, and yet he's also a prisoner of his past.
Well, I think it goes back a little bit to what you had said about all of us being unable to escape our past, and he's not certainly not exempt from that, in that he certainly is not a total prisoner, but an inheritor of his past, and that he maybe this is the ultimate punishment on some way for him, and that he's as afraid of these people as they were once of him, and their punishment of him, if you will, is a lot simpler. You know, he lives with the constant threat of discovery, and he sort of passed that on to his family, and that his daughter, his wife, is afraid of discovery by association to him, and his daughter now is. So that his punishment, as one of the characters says to him, and that because the last person who he had encountered in the prison had left a marker on him, a kind of scar, to make sure that he would never be able to erase this past, that he would always be asked about his face, or that there would be a reminder of it, a kind of marker of it. So on some level, he is a if not a prisoner, but a very he's afraid of and his terror, unlike the people he terrorized, his terror now has lasted 30 years, and theirs does too. But his punishment is ongoing, in that he's unable to go back to his country, and he's, you know, he's had to change his name and redefine himself, and lives in this constant fear. And maybe that's the punishment. And the people who, and we've had actual people in this situation, you know, famous sort of torturers from Haiti who relocate to the United States. And what pains the community on some level is when they're not ashamed, is when they sort of walk around fearlessly, and that other people are angered by their presence, but they seem calmer. So that in some ways he's doing his time, and by being terrified of discovery, by sort of living in fear all the time.
Hmm. One of the stories concerns the same family, and they go to mass on it's on Christmas Eve,
mm-hmm.
and they're there, and I think it is the mother spots somebody, a man sitting in a pew a few rows up, and thinks that maybe he looks like someone who was a torturer, and someone apparently had gone around the neighborhood and put up pictures of this man, in fact, like a wanted poster.
Mm-hmm.
And so she sees him and thinks that perhaps it might be him, and in fact goes up to take communion and comes back, and she's walking back down the aisle, and she stops and actually looks the man right in the face, because she wants to know whether it is or it isn't. And apparently it turns out that it's not. But that I was very struck by that, and I wondered, you know, is that kind of thing does actually happen? That is, that people do, are people always kind of looking and looking for people like that?
Well, people, there was a time, in the 60s, 70s, when people were being exiled, you know, in large numbers by the dictatorship. And in that moment, there were, you know, there was a little bit of, a lot of suspicion in some cases of people wondering if someone had been sent into the community to spy for the government and so forth. So there was that sort of looking around. Now, in the current moment, we have, you know, there's a few really famous, let's say, famous people who, one of them most notably is, and actually the real name of this person, is Emmanuel Constant, who is a man who started a group called called FRAP in Haiti in the early 1990s, and where a lot of people were killed by these people. And he was sent, he was given asylum in the United States, and at some point was going to be deported to Haiti, but went on 60 Minutes and said that he had been working for the CIA, and now they were trying to discard him. And so because of that, he got to stay. And actually just recently, there have been these demonstrations outside of his house and his workplace. And actually, a couple of days ago, a group marched in front of his house to demand that he be detained, or that not return to Haiti right now. But he had been tried in absentia in Haiti. So there are some sort of well-known people. Like, there was a man in Florida who was working in Disneyland who was recently deported, but in the recent events in Haiti was was released from prison. There are some that people can name, but there are others that maybe someone might have encountered, someone who is just like anybody else, but that some might encounter and sort of have a striking moment of recognition from.
In your previous writing, the characters were women, and one of the things that you explored was relationship between mothers and daughters. In this particular book, the male characters, I think, are a little bit more important, more developed, and certainly there's this father-daughter relationship. Was that something that you, in having written more about women in the past, did you set out to try to write more about men, or to have men be the characters that were going to be more important in the story?
I didn't set out to do it necessarily, but what happened when I started writing about this particular period of the 29-year dictatorship, I found that there was so much language that instead of that referred to fatherland, let's say, as opposed to motherland. For example, you know, François Duvalier, who is called Papa Doc, he used to refer to himself as the, you know, the sovereign one, the renovator of the fatherland. And in 1963, when a Life magazine reporter asked him, you know, some question, he said, you know, he said, Haitians, I am the Haitians have no father. They have only me. I'm the father, and the Virgin Mary's their mother. So there was this whole discourse, you know. He was, of course, called Papa Doc. He was everybody's father. So this whole discourse of fatherland and this paternalistic relationship of power to ordinary people, you know, this Papa who rules over everybody, was something that fascinated me. So then I started exploring this relationship, you know, how this relationship is replicated and these father-daughter and, you know, father-son, and how people pass things on. So it ended up being more, there's probably just one story, I think, where it's only women in the story, but it ended up being about a lot about men. And that was interesting to do, you know, to explore these voices, too. And hoping as I was writing along that I would be able to do them justice.
Mm-hmm. I have read some of the, this is probably some of the older articles about you, particularly when you were first published and were nominated for the book award, talking about how you always had this idea that you would be a writer, that you wanted to be a writer, but that particularly your family thought that, well, writing's not really a job. Writing's not an occupation. You really need to have a job, and you were going to study nursing, and then when you got the scholarship to go to college, then you started to get more interested in writing, which is what you really wanted to do. I guess I'm interested in how your parents feel these days about your writing, and whether they now are persuaded that this is actually a serious career.
Well, my parents also having spent most of their life under the dictatorship, a lot of, you know, it was a very serious thing because in the 60s we lost, for example, one of our greatest writers, Jacques Tiffin-Alexis, to the dictatorship, and a lot of the other writers were exiled. And one particularly fabulous woman writer, Marie Chauvet, was going to have her book published in France and, you know, with endorsement from Simone de Beauvoir and among others. And her family was so frightened that when the book came out that they would be in danger, that they bought the whole stock of 5,000 books. So there were so many stories like that where writers were in danger that when I told, actually, my uncle, when I was about 9, was the first person I told. And so I told him I wanted to be a writer, and he just cited those cases to me that everybody sort of knew on some level. So in one, you know, when I was much younger, even before I came here, the writing was, they discouraged me for some other reasons, for safety reasons. Hmm. And when I came, you know, to New York, my parents had worked really hard to get, you know, my brother and myself here. And so they saw it as a kind of tenuous possibility, you know, this, you know, that if even if you succeed, you know, if you will, that it's a difficult thing to maintain. And so you had this feeling, too, that it's like all immigrant families, I think, that so many sacrifices had been made for you to be, you know, to be, period, but also to be here, to have this life that they had fought so hard for, that they wanted me to have a sort of a more secure career. So they encouraged me towards what I call the trinity of possible careers, you know, to be a doctor or a lawyer or engineer. And I ended up deciding, sort of compromising with them, that I was going to be a nurse. And then I went to volunteer in a hospital as was part of my program. I was at Clara Barton High School for the Health Professions in Brooklyn. And they had a program where you volunteered in hospitals, and I did that. But I found that it made me incredibly sad, that I would be able to live like that. So, and when I did get the scholarship, I sort of, a door opened in which I saw a kind of more liberal education. And then I studied French literature and a little in economics to sort of balance that. And so, they right now, you know, they feel okay, but they still sometimes, you know, they still say, you know, what if you run out of ideas or something?
Well, when you consider the number of writers that are able to support themselves from their writing, I guess you would have to say that your parents were right in their concerns.
And I say that to when I speak to schools and when I teach, I always say that to the students, that it's not all that impractical to have something else that you do, because a lot of writers end up also teaching while they're writing to support themselves.
Do I have it right that you live in now in Miami?
Yes. I moved to Miami about a year and a half ago.
Was that a difficult decision to move from New York, where you had done a lot of your growing up and had lived there for what must have been maybe 15 years or more?
Yeah. I lived in, I would say something like, you know, 20 plus years. I moved to for a rather old-fashioned reason. I got married, and my husband has a business in Miami, and it was easier for me to move than for him. But I'm in New York maybe a month out of, you know, a week out of the month, visiting my parents. I have a lot of family there. It's been interesting because I always have this fear when I go anywhere, for some stretches, that maybe that I won't be able to write in that place. So my fear wasn't so much about leaving Brooklyn, but being in a place that I'm perhaps unsure that I would be able to write. So, I find it very interesting, sort of and I've always found that once I've left, you know, having left places sort of gives me a different perspective to writing about them. So now I have this combination of possibilities where I can, you know, either write about Miami, or I can write about Brooklyn, or I can write about Haiti. So it adds sort of another landscape, I feel, to my imagination.
Let me reintroduce, we're a little bit past our midpoint here, and reintroduce our guest, Edwige Dandika. She's a writer. She was born in Haiti. She came to the United States when she was 12. She is the author now of several books, including Breath, Eyes, Memory. That was a selection of Oprah Winfrey's book club. Also, Crick Crack, a National Book Award finalist, and The Farming of Bones, which was a winner of the American Book Award. She has a new novel, which is titled The Dewbreaker, and it's published by Knopf. She is traveling around the country talking about it, and she's in Chicago. She will be doing an appearance and a book signing at the Borders Bookstore in Beverly at 2210 West 95th. So if there are people listening in the Chicago area, that's 7:30 tonight. And, of course, head out to your local bookstore, and you can find all of her books. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I wonder, do you think that your writing, the way that you use English, has been at all shaped by the fact that that was not your first language, and that when you came to the United States, you spoke French and Creole, but not, as I understand it, not very much English.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I didn't speak any English at all, and on some level, I think that was a good thing for me, because I. When you're new to a language, you know, even after this many years, a couple of decades, there's still some things that startle you, in the language, and there's still a kind of playful approach to it, you know, in ways that you feel like you can, there's just the imagery. There are things that are so new that it sort of lends itself to a kind of creativity, you know, sort of like a double creativity in the writing. So I think also, you know, English on some level is very flexible, is wide-ranging in that, you know, you have, you know, Shakespeare's English, you have Toni Morrison's English, you have Sandra Cisneros' English. So it allows on some level a veil of other languages to peek through. So I often see my, you know, Creole infusing itself in my English. And so I felt like it was a great thing. And the more languages you know, I think the more your things that you're open to. But it was never tragic, I think, having to learn a new language, because it certainly enriched my Creole on some level, because I had sort of new ways to translate certain experiences or certain imagery. But also, I think the Creole enriches my English at the same time.
Hmm. How much is of Creole is French or is like French?
Well, Creole, I mean, in our particular case in Haiti, the French that that it influenced, it's influenced by is sort of older French. I would say, you know, we had a break with the French, you know, sort of daily infusion of French when the colonization ended in 1804, and as a matter of fact, you know, this year is the bicentennial of Haitian independence. So it's the French that's there. If you hear people from Haiti, for example, speaking, you'll hear less contemporary French than you would hear people from Martinique or Guadeloupe. So there's a strong French influence, but there's also the strong influence of African languages and some Spanish, and now more and more English because of sort of the back and forth with the diaspora community, but Creole in the beginning, you know, languages go through that many steps towards it goes from pidgin to actually a Creole to a dialect to an actual language with which Creole is fully with grammatical, with phonetics and grammar, but it originally was a way for a lot for the slaves who came from Africa, who were brought from Africa to the island, and the French who brought them, or the Spanish who brought them, to communicate.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that some people, at least, are familiar with what's been going on in Haiti over the last few months. At least they probably have seen some of the stories about the political unrest there that eventually led to the president, Mr. Aristide, leaving. What is, I guess, I'm not even quite sure how to frame the question. I'm interested in what you think and how you understand what has happened there in the last couple of months.
Well, For me, I mean, I think, like, as for a lot of Haitians, it's a bit sad that we've had this this turmoil, this situation on the bicentennial of Haitian independence. You know, this year will make 200 years of independence since the first Black Republic in this in the Western Hemisphere, the Second Republic, next to the United States, the first successful slave revolt, you know, the only one in history. And so I think, like a lot of us, I was very much looking forward to commemorating that in a way, you know, because it's a big, accomplishment for in our history, and something that, you know, even when we're going through hard times, we cite, because it's something that sort of gives us strength. So that was sidelined by all that went on, was a little bit sad. I mean, it's a complicated, it's a very complicated situation. And now I, you know, with what's going on, what I'm hoping will happen is that, you know, with the current people who are there, Mr. Latortu, that in some ways that there'll be a kind of reunification. I mean, unfortunately, it doesn't seem like that just yet, but that, you know, that they'll have quick elections and really start, you know, start over. It's a symbolic moment, really, for starting over, and I hope that can happen.
Mm-hmm. Certainly there are connections between Haiti and the United States, among them the fact there are a lot of Haitian Americans. The United States, at least at one point, was committed enough to Aristide to actually intervene militarily to put him back in power after he was ousted by the coup. And he spent most of his first term as president living in the United States, and then went back just kind of for the tail end with the help of American military. Now, just more recently, the United States government at least has said that they don't, at least initially, they said, well, we don't see any interest here. That's when I think the Secretary of State was questioned about the possibility of sending troops back again. And he essentially said, well, I don't think that there's really any, we don't really have enough interest here to warrant that. So I guess it makes you wonder about this relationship between the United States and Haiti, and what Americans, particularly the American government, could do that would be constructive, and whether people in the government or people in the United States, in fact, do think that we have some kind of interest in a stable and democratic Haiti.
Well, I think, I mean, it's obvious that there is some interest. Maybe it's not clear to the larger, you know, like the sort of the ordinary people among us, like myself. But there's obviously an interest because the United States has been, actually, you know, has intervened or has had a force in Haiti the three times, really, in the last 100 years or so. There was a U.S. occupation of Haiti that lasted 19 years at the beginning of the last century, and then we had, you know, in the 1990s, 20,000 troops come, and now you have, you know, you had a very strong involvement of the United States in the removal of President Aristide. Whether it happened exactly the way they said or the way he said, so the truth is somewhere there. But they participated very actively in his removal. So there is some interest, and maybe it's the location it's always seemed. Of course, you know, nations don't have friends; they have interest, and they have to people. They become powerful by watching out for their interest, and maybe this, you know, in the most recent interventions that had to do with sort of stopping the flow of refugees. But I think what would be it would be interesting to see something done in a way that this doesn't have to keep repeating, and that, you know, a situation is allowed to deteriorate. And then you have the Marines sweep in. That hasn't seemed to be, in the last three times that we've had, that it hasn't seemed to offer any permanent solution to the problem.
Mm. I'm sure that in interviews people ask you, as I have done now, to comment on current Haitian politics. And that's something at least maybe not current, but Haitian politics does run through your writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how you feel about being put in that position to and suddenly a conversation turning from a conversation about writing to a conversation about politics.
Well, I don't have a problem with that too much. Sometimes I do feel a little bit ill-equipped, and I can only really offer my own personal feeling. And that's gotten me into a little sort of trouble, you know, like in last week when I was in Washington, I had sort of four people stump out as I was speaking, which I've never had happen before. And it's because it had sort of turned to politics. So it's a very complicated situation. Sometimes I wish I had sort of a historian and a, you know, an economist or sort of all these experts with me to help. But I just can only offer my my point of view, which is one particular point of view. But I feel like the way I speak most clearly, perhaps, is through the fiction, and that really with the fiction you have the luxury of nuance, and you have the opportunity or the privilege to look at a situation from many different perspectives, from many different points of view, so that you don't have that sort of easily polarized side-taking that people are always forcing on me. You know, there's often in Haitian politics, there's no neutral ground. You have to sort of be on this side or be on the other side, and that's really not my tendency, both as a person and as a fiction writer, because I'm so used to being able to present really all kinds of perspectives in the things that I'm writing, because I can do that through characters and I can do that through different people. And it also takes me a long time to process certain things. And so I'm not able to react very, very quickly, which is, which I've had to kind of learn to do in recent weeks.
Yeah. Well, did the people who got up and left in Washington, was it because they were expecting a literary discussion, it became political, or it was because the political viewpoint that you were offering they didn't like?
Well, because I think, you know, it's very interesting, and I say it as an anecdote, sort of like where literature and that and the politics meet in a very strong way. It suddenly became kind of like a rally where people disagreed with you, and that we were having the discussion was going well, and then until someone asked that question, I could hear the gasp in the room, because it was sort of inconvenient for some people that like wanted to keep it not political. And then actually then when I said something, and then the people who disagreed with me, because I sort of heard hear reports of people who heard them outside that they were angry about what I had said. And so it's always a, you know, a high wire, sort of you're balancing it. And there are times when I feel like sort of, you know, saying, don't ask me any political questions, but that would be a kind of censoring, and I think, you know, and the books are political. And so I just sort of, what I'm putting, I just put my opinion next to everybody else's. It doesn't mean that it weighs more than other people, that it means more. But it's just from my particular perspective.
Hmm. Well, about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 5, Haiti. We're talking with writer Edwige Dandika, and her new book is The Dewbreaker. It's published by Knopf, and she is in Chicago to talk about it. Questions, again, if somebody wanted to call real quick, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I expect probably in every interview, at some point, the interviewer asks you about the title, and mm-hmm. I guess I'll do... I was thinking, can I get through the entire interview without doing that? I'm thinking to myself, I'm sure she's sick about telling the story about the title, but I think I will ask it, and I think it's interesting, and it refers to the man that we're talking about, the torturer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I've always had that with all my titles on some level. People always say, "What does the title mean?" You know, from Breath Eyes Memory to Click Crack to this title. This title, the Dewbreaker, comes from a Creole expression, Chouquette Laouze, which refers to someone who was a what we call a chef de section or a section chief, or sort of a kind of princely figure in the rural area. Who he was judge, executioner, notary public. So it's pretty much the legal authority of his village and often abused that privilege for anything from, you know, sexual favors to taking people's land and so forth. So he was a, you know, this was the kind of person who was considered a particularly cool kind of person. Now, this the main character who's called the Dewbreaker in this book, he doesn't work in the rural area. He works in the city. He sort of runs his own little section of these barracks, and he's judge, executioner, sort of everything in his little section of that, and is named that as a kind of slight because he's as cool as these other people in the rural area. So it's that's the literal meaning of it, you know, of the Creole phrase Shuket Lawazee is dew shaker or dew stumper, and he is someone basically who, you know, these are people who basically wanted to keep back the night, you know, that's the figurative meaning, in that they wanted to stump on the dew, in the same way that, you know, you would someone would want to break somebody's spirit, they wanted to stump the dew. But what's also hopeful in this very lyrical yet phrase, you know, the paradox of the phrase is that you can't break the dew. You know, you can try pretty hard, but you can't break the dew any more than you can break anybody's spirit.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's a little startling when you take that. It's very poetic. It's a lovely phrase. If you don't know what it means, at least the certain levels of it, then when you think that it does refer to this person and what they do, it offers a whole different sort of feeling, I guess.
Yeah, I've always thought that that's also a wonderful feature of the Creole, is that it's a very poetic language, and maybe it's because it had to rise really out of pain, you know, this sort of middle communication between people who are owned by people and the people who own them, and so there's this very lyrical element and very strong imagery that's part of the Creole, and it's fun to translate too. It's fun to try at least to carry some of that into the English, and this title is a great example of that too. There's also another expression that's connected to the dew. That's the title of a great Haitian novel that was translated by Langston Hughes and Mercer Cook called Masters of the Dew, and the Masters of the Dew are people who worked the earth, who sort of tried to regain their destiny by finding water or planting their gardens. So on some level, you know, you see on the symbolic level, the Haitian history has always been a kind of war between the dew breakers and the masters of the dew, and the dew masters, if you will.
We have about 5 minutes left. I have a caller here, someone who'd like to join in the conversation. Let's do that. They're in Urbana, and it's line one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to ask you. It's not a stereotypical sort of question, but a lot of what Americans think of when they think of Haiti is voodoo, I'm afraid. And I'm wondering whether you have ever been able to treat that in a way. I've heard that Papa Doc actually manipulated people with voodoo some, and actually, but it's never been regarded as a religion. It's never been accorded any kind of official status. In fact, I think that Aristide was talking about doing that, and it actually bothered people in some places, in different maybe missionaries and others. But that's all a little bit of a preamble to just asking you if you've been able to sort of. It is the religion of the poor, and it's comparable to Santeria in some of the Spanish-speaking islands, where it was the animist religion that came over with the slaves. So I'm wondering if you, in these few short minutes, you might be able to say something that would illuminate that aspect of Haitian culture to us. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much for that question. Well, voodoo is a religion that comes to us from our African ancestors, and actually it recently was one of the last year was made an official religion by President Aristide. That did go through, and now votaries are people who practice voodoo are able to baptize, have baptisms, have the equivalent there of that, or have or conduct marriages. And voodoo has always been It is the religion of a lot of people. But Also, the Protestant Church has recently gained a lot of ground in Haiti, but it's nothing like sort of the stereotypical things that we see here. It's a healing religion. A lot of people who are not able to afford doctors are able to go to the priest, and he's able to, or she, or some, it's the priestess often too, is able to treat them with leave. So there's this connection to the community, and even, you know, in terms of offering healing services. But it's a religion that is very much tied to the history of Haiti, that a lot of the great battles, you know, in 1791 when the slave leader Boukman gathered in Bois-Caïman, which is sort of in the pivotal ceremony that started the Haitian Revolution, where people vowed to end a voodoo ceremony to be free or to die. So it's very tied to Haiti spirituality and history, but it's a religion that's also been very much persecuted. You know, in the 1940s, they had the Catholic Church had a whole large anti-superstition campaign, and which actually was the beginning of widespread erosion, in that they destroyed with the silk cotton trees, which are considered temples for the spirits. So it's a religion that has been persecuted, but lately, more recently, has been seeing a kind of had been slowly seeing a kind of emergence, especially with the official status that it was recently granted, and that I hope will keep going. We had a recent encounter with some of the people who came. Some of these rebels destroyed several artifacts at a museum in Port-au-Prince. But I think, you know, as a religion of the people, as it sort of it's lasted through the history, I think it will last no matter what else is going on in the country.
There we'll have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. Ms. Dandekat, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
We're talking with us. We appreciate it. Edwige Dandekat, her new book is The Dewbreaker. It's published by Knopf. And I do want to mention one more time for people who might be listening in the Chicago area, she'll be doing a book signing at the Borders at 2210 West 95th in Beverly tonight at 7:30. Otherwise, wherever you live, you head down to the bookstore and look for her writing.